By a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
We wish to thank a special group of friends of WILL, the members of the WILL Legacy Circle, for providing for the future of WILL Radio through gifts that they've planned in their wills and estate documents. For more information about making such a gift, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-0850. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The son of migrant workers, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, grew up in poverty. He also graduated from Rice University and Harvard Law and became part of the inner circle of George W. Bush. Our guest today is journalist Bill Minutaglio. He is the author, most recently, of The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. The book covers Gonzalez's life from his boyhood in Humble, Texas, a little town near Houston, through his tenure as White House counsel. It looks at Gonzalez's rise to power. The book begins with this sentence. After several months of research and more than 200 interviews with colleagues, close friends, and fierce critics, a clear pattern was emerging. Alberto Gonzalez had been crafting and processing the most secretive and controversial directives in modern U.S. history, but he had somehow managed to remain the most hidden member of the Bush family's inner circle. And he says this early on in this biography: "There is one thing the Attorney General's critics and allies can agree on. He is unquestioningly loyal to the Bush dynasty." Listeners, I invite your questions about Alberto Gonzalez for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Bill Minutaglio is the author of two previous books, including First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. He has written for many publications, including Talk, The New York Times, Outside, and Details. His new book, The President's Counselor, is published by Rayo, an imprint of HarperCollins. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Bill Minutaglio, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome. Well, Alberto Gonzalez is a man who is loyal to his chief, and this is something we've heard about many of the administration's inner circle. By looking at Gonzalez, what do we learn about the administration of George W. Bush? What do we learn about President Bush?
Sure. Yeah, I think one way to authentically look at President Bush is through the prism of his father. What George W. Bush decided to do en route to Washington and what he's doing right now is born out of his own experience in watching his father and frankly, serving his father's administration. Toward the end of the elder George Bush's administration in 1992, George W. Bush came to Washington and witnessed what he told friends was a ship that had run amok and that was now being disserviced in some way by disloyal aides to his father. And when he was planning to go to Washington, he was pretty much hell-bent on surrounding himself with folks who were going to be, frankly, abjectly loyal, people who were not going to go to the media and leak things to the media, cooperate with the media, or even just more broadly kind of grandstand to the point where they would become almost the focus of the story and not the president, be the sort of the lightning rod for the administration. So he felt his father had truly been served poorly by almost rebellious staff towards the end of his administration. That accounted for his loss in being, quote, expelled from the White House when moving to Washington. No great secret, George W. Bush brought along probably more famous folks, at least more well-known folks right now, Karl Rove and Karen Hughes, most notably people who maybe by dint of their personalities and even their professions within the Bush administration were a little more, quote, out front. But as I worked on my biography of George W. Bush, which first came out in 1999 and then was reissued in 2001, there was a recurring figure. I kind of compared it to a photograph. You would see George W. Bush in the center of the frame and maybe off to the side a little bit, Karl Rove and Karen Hughes. But somewhere in the background, always, in every picture, was Alberto Gonzalez. And yet it seemed as if he was almost hidden, just a little bit in the shadows. And my contention is that at present, he is the most private public figure in modern American politics. He is the Attorney General. He has served this president as the in-house White House counsel, but so little had been known about him that I thought he was worth writing about.
Yeah. Well, now today, and since being sworn in as Attorney General, he is, I would say, no longer the most hidden member of the Bush family's inner circle. And today, July 18th, 2006, he was before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where, again, he faced a good deal of heat on a range of issues, including the anti-terror eavesdropping program.
Absolutely. I think he's learned that there's an acute political dimension to to public service now, and especially in this capacity. And it's been interesting to watch that evolution for many, many years. Even before linking up with the Bush family, he had been kind of a shadow warrior and frankly treasured for being a guy who had ultimate discretion and, again, fiercely loyal to his clients. He had served as a corporate lawyer for many years, almost 15 years in Houston, Texas, before essentially being recruited by the Bush family to work with them. And then even when he did go to work for them in early stages, a lot of his activities and legal counseling was done, way in the background in the form of memos and position papers and kind of closed-door conferences. And as a personality evolution, I think he really jumped into the deep end of the pool once he was sworn in as Attorney General. And frankly, the Bushes, who in my estimation, tend to always measure, the long-range impact of their personnel decisions. How will this person play, 5-10 years down the road as a possible figure in a future Bush administration, or perhaps to run for some other office? I think it's been part of this grooming process for Gonzalez. I can't predict the future. I wish I could, but there's still a sense that he might be on some form of a list for nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court, and if not that, then a list that would have him running for either the governor's office or the Senate, perhaps in Texas.
You really think he has a shot at the U.S. Supreme Court?
If you'd asked me 5 or 6 months ago and I had to, go down to the betting window and place some money on that, I wouldn't have bet on that horse named Alberto Gonzalez. It just seemed an impossibility. A half a year ago, he was still whipsawed by I think the same swirling bits of circumstances and accusations that were leveled against Harriet Myers. One thing that my research showed me is that Myers and Gonzalez, in many, many ways, are joined at the hip. They've traded jobs, in essence, within the Bush administration and Bush orbit for many, many years. They've recommended each other for various positions and in a lot of ways are viewed, I suppose, both intellectually, the same way. They're measured along the same intellectual standards. And they've been accused of many of the same things by even conservative critics of perhaps not being a stout-hearted conservative. My point being is that 6 months ago, Gonzalez was on a list that might have put him, there along with Harriet Myers as a possible Supreme Court candidate. And when her nomination was doomed and cast about in really a negative light, he went swirling down, in the mm-hmm. backdraft of that. I think, and I hear this from folks in Washington, that in some ways he's been a little bit rehabilitated in some eyes in Washington, in the sense that he's proved over these last several months, especially as he's been grilled in Washington on a lot of the contentious post 9/11 issues that he's weighed in on, as being a more of a stout-hearted conservative. So the accusations that were leveled against him as maybe being a closet liberal in some way have abated a little bit, and that the other dimension is that, and this is really hard to pin down with George W. Bush, and I think a lot of folks who write about him and think about him underestimate this element. He really does have this acute personal loyalty, and he views it as a two-way street. And when he knows that someone like Gonzalez or Karl Rove or even Karen Hughes, other folks have proved themselves and really, danced across coals on his behalf, he does have a personal sense that I must remain loyal to them and maybe fly in the face of prevailing wisdom and conventional wisdom and even the good advice that he might be getting from his political advisors and roll the dice and say, you know what, I found this man to be loyal to me. I'm going to be loyal to him and continue to try to advance his career and renominate him to the Supreme Court. I think you saw a little bit of that with Rove and with Dick Cheney. Certainly, when people out there, political pundits, were calling for their heads at various moments over the last several years, and Bush stood fast. And I think he might be tempted to do the same thing with Gonzalez.
I wonder if it wasn't that jury summons that came along in 1996 and what Gonzalez did for George W. Bush when Bush was governor of Texas, if that was the moment that really sealed his loyalty, his value to Governor Bush.
It's a great, great observation, and I appreciate your bringing it up. And I happen to agree with you. I think that was a fateful moment. I don't want to, draw into much of Shakespeare or Greek tragedy, but it was a moment of profound, I would say, compromise. And I've been describing it in almost a parallel to an old blues image, blues music image, when someone goes down to the crossroads and they're faced with making a pact with some higher power, and fate, history, and circumstance all kind of converge at the same crossroads, and you make a deep decision to go a particular direction. What happened, in essence, to summarize, is that George W. Bush, then governor of Texas, was called to serve on a drunk driving trial in Texas, and in the weeks building up to it, he was notably publicly very excited about that possibility and had talked quite a bit about wanting to perform his public service and how he felt that folks in high office in Texas were as obligated as anybody else to serve on jury. So he was looking forward to doing his public service. But the very day that he was to sit or be measured for inclusion on the jury, Alberto Gonzalez, then serving as Governor Bush's, quote, in-house counsel, basically went into the judge's chambers and offered a passionate, last-minute, emotional plea to have his client, Governor Bush, removed from consideration on the jury. He claimed that it would be a conflict of interest in case the person who was up on these drunk driving charges was convicted. They might in some way want to appeal, ultimately, to the governor for clemency. I can tell you, and most legal experts can tell you here in Texas, that that probably was never going to happen. That kind of legal episode just never unfolds in Texas. So it caused folks here, myself included, to wonder, was there a different reason for wanting to excuse then-Governor Bush from the this drunk driving trial? And it so turns out that there's a big, broad body of evidence, and even specific evidence, that indicates that the real maneuver by gubernatorial counsel Alberto Gonzalez was to basically protect Governor Bush from having to reveal something about his own brush with the law in a drunk driving case, and that being a younger George W. Bush back in the mid-1970s being arrested for drunk driving outside the family estate in Kennebunkport, Maine. That fact, that brush with the law, had remained very well hidden through Bush's congressional race here in Texas and through his gubernatorial race. So there were many, many moments when it could have been revealed and maybe the air cleared, but it was clearly kept hidden. And there was some sense within the Bush network in orbit that as the governor was going to be a member of this drunk driving jury, that the circumstances of his own arrest in connection with the drunk driving would be revealed, and by extension, that it would negatively impact his race for the presidency, that it wouldn't reflect well on him. I maintain, and many people who know Gonzalez even better than I think I do now, contend that that's where he went down to the crossroads. That's where that almost blood oath loyalty pact evolved, that George W. Bush saw Gonzalez do something that Bush has almost famously called throwing yourself on the grenade for the Bush family. He went down to the crossroads, I believe, and made sort of a legal decision to, in essence, mask, mute, divert attention away from a blemish on his client's record, and I think to protect his political interests for his advance on the White House.
Mm. Also, the issue of Gonzalez's background, his Hispanic heritage, also has played a role in how he was welcomed into the Bush inner circle.
Absolutely. I think, when you chart Gonzalez's path, and you described it wonderfully, he grew up as the son of migrant workers. He himself did some migrant worker work in the cotton fields of south central Texas, but his father was an alcoholic who only had a second grade education. His mother had only achieved a sixth grade education. And much of his success as he moved beyond that world, he joined the Air Force out of high school and then transferred to the U.S. Air Force Academy. From there, transferred to Rice University, which folks here in Texas like to call the Harvard of the South. And then, of course, moved on to Harvard Law School. A lot of those stops along the way were clearly influenced by movements at each of those institutions and stops to increase minority participation. You can pick different words to apply, to what was happening then, whether it was, strictly, quote, affirmative action, whether quotas were in place. It was clear that in this time period, generally speaking, from the mid-70s up through the mid-80s as he was advancing through these different stops, it's pretty clear, looking at paperwork, looking at statements issued by folks at the various institutions, at the Air Force Academy, at Rice, and at Harvard, and even at the law firm, the high-end law firm that he joined after Harvard Law School back in Houston, that Gonzalez was the right guy at the right time when doors were being specifically and literally opened to admit more minorities. You could leap forward further, and this gets really acutely political and gets to those long-range ambitions of the Bush family and network. As Gonzalez became a very prominent attorney in Houston, Texas, working for a big law firm, by the way, named Vinson and Elkins, mm-hmm. which has pejoratively been nicknamed Vinson and Enron, owing to the fact that their primary client for many years was Enron. Gonzalez joined that firm, worked there for a number of years, and began, I would say, kind of moving a little bit above the cloud line in a big city like Houston, an affluent, powerful city like Houston. And by dint of doing that corporate law at such a high end, and frankly, really working with Enron, he began becoming exposed to the Bush family, Houston being, in a lot of ways, the financial headquarters of the Bush political network. And it coincided uniquely with the time period when the elder George Bush was running for the presidency and had decided, with the help of Karl Rove and Lee Atwater and some other political advisors, that they simply needed to do more to attract Latino voters, to attract Hispanic voters across the country. And here's a fellow named Alberto Gonzalez, who's seen as a rising Republican star and a stalwart in business circles, affiliated through his law firm with the company Enron, that's simply one of the biggest contributors to the Bush political campaign coffers. And very quickly, Alberto Gonzalez got on the radar. So it was a twofold dimension, and in large part informed by the Bush family's thought that we need to include more Hispanics in our immediate orbit so that we can attract more voters.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist Bill Menotaglio. He is the author most recently of The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting for us in Decatur on line 4. Good afternoon. Listener there? I think I'm afraid I might have kept that caller waiting just a tad too long.
I'm going to take responsibility. I tend to give speeches. I'm almost becoming a politician, so you'll forgive me, Celeste.
So anyway, if that listener would like to give us a call back, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. That idea of moving above the cloud line in Houston, that's a very interesting choice of words. It must have been quite something for this fellow to look at where he has come from and where he is now. And throughout the story, the character that keeps rearing up in front of me is Faust.
It's a great comparison, and I wish I had thought to include that in the book because it's very apt. I do believe that Alberto Gonzalez's life has been filled with a lot of conflict and compromise and measuring, you know, where he's come from and where he wants to go to and how he's going to get there and who's going to help him. And, you know, we all make compromises in life, and a lot of times I think we'd be foolish to ignore, you know, a hand extended to us. It's good to have friends, I suppose, in high places in certain circumstances. When you weigh in the extra political dimension, it becomes more challenging and so forth, and the fact that we're talking about, you know, really grave issues and men hopefully who are serious in terms of, you know, their approach to problems that need to be solved and addressed. It's just clear that he went a long way. And I referenced an interesting book, a lovely book, a great book, written by Larry McMurtry, one of our finest Texas authors and really a national treasure. He has a book titled "All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers," and I found that kind of an apt title or reference in some way to what Gonzalez was doing and experiencing on a personal level. And again, I don't mean to get Shakespearean too much, or even dip into Greek tragedy as well. But I enjoy looking at the people that I've written about through that prism of personality and who they know. And I believe you can connect the dots from the way they were raised and the compromises and personal entanglements, both good and bad, that they've made over time to really exactly the public policies later on that they're affiliated with.
And also one's moment in history.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just it marks him and places him in time. Folks told me, it was interesting as I was getting deeper, I think it's interesting, as I was getting deeper and deeper into my research, that folks who knew him very well began reminding me of something that I think it seemed so obvious that I had, you know, left behind. They said, you really, really, really need, go back there and revisit, you know, the street that he grew up on, really, you know, examine the world that he emerged from, really, really understand that there was no hot running water in his house, that he had no telephone up through his high school years at his house, you know, for the family to use, that there were seven brothers and sisters shoehorned into a tiny wooden shack that his father had built with his own hands. Really, you know, really weigh that, really think about it, and think about how, you know, what that means in terms of his clawing to where he is, but also think of it in the context of how abjectly loyal he is to Bush and how grateful he is to Bush for advancing him even beyond the certain upper-end circumstances that Gonzalez had achieved on his own. It's clear, really, that Gonzalez would not have been in the public eye and public arena without George W. Bush. Like him or not, divorced from how you feel about him politically, he has, or he did become our first Latino White House counsel. He is our first Latino attorney general. If, you know, fate, circumstance, whatever, you know, applies, Democrats and Republicans both willing, and he enters the Supreme Court, he'll really make history as the first Latino there. And so what I've been reminded of over and over again is really measure that, measure perhaps how Gonzalez really does deeply in his core and marrow feel a personal debt to George W. Bush, someone who could almost be considered his the older brother that Gonzalez never had for reaching down and bringing him even further than he had gotten earlier in life.
Let's take a call. Listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Good afternoon. Here's some related items and a question after. In today's news, NPR reports that President Bush personally stopped an investigation by the Justice Department of the National Security Agency tapping phones. So that's, you know, under Mr. Gonzalez. You know, on the theme of personal loyalty, some time back, WILL interviewed a diplomat who resigned in disgust from the State Department, and I called in and asked him if Condoleezza Rice was qualified to be Secretary of State. He answered by saying, "She keeps the president happy." That kind of goes in with the loyalty thing and that you just described, loyalty to President Bush. My question is, have you received any political static since your book came out? And I'll hang up and listen to that answer.
Sure. That's it. I'm only laughing because I really appreciate those observations, by the way. They're really very germane and important observations. And I was laughing only because of the use of the word static, because it sure seems to me, and I'm not proud to be a paranoid person. I've been a journalist for almost 30 years, and I've written a lot of things for a lot of publications. And I like to think that I'm not really looking in my rearview mirror a whole lot for you know, low-flying black helicopters. But I can tell you that in working in my first on my George W. Bush book, there was literally a lot of static on my phone at some point, and there were an unusual number of coincidences that emerged that seemed to, intrigue, and then maybe those dark moments night kind of alarm me. You know, how did someone know that I was working on this particular angle or story? And I had that same gnawing feeling welling up again a little bit as I worked on this book, and yet the deeper you go into the rabbit hole and try to explore things that are still evolving, you know, in real time, as that erudite caller just noted, we're still learning about domestic spying. It's being played out on the front pages of the papers and on the airwaves literally as we speak, and I don't know that we'll know for many years to come. It's a secret program that a secret and clandestine, and I suppose it'll take a while for us to figure out exactly who started it and exactly where it went and toward what degree it affected each of us individually. So I've gotten some static, yes, of course, and like a lot of things, I probably am happy in some ways. I've gotten static from both sides of the aisle, left and right, Democrat and Republican. Some folks feeling that I was too easy on Gonzalez, others saying that I was too harsh. I had one interesting review comment that Gonzalez really wasn't worth writing about. It was actually written by an academician here in Texas, and I found that almost staggering in the sense that the man's the Attorney General and had served as White House counsel, and his imprint is on some very, very important documents dating back to his service as George Bush's counsel in the governor's office here. Gonzalez weighed in on dozens and dozens of cases where people were put to death, and I don't know what could be more grave than that. So he's a man of consequence, of course, and I did receive a little bit of static. And to finally stop sounding like a politician, to finally address your caller's observation about loyalty, I think that the true thing that Gonzalez has been wrestling with is that he had been always off in the corner of that photo frame that I described earlier. He's never been front and center, but by dint of being sworn in as Attorney General in 1995, he's had to learn to be out front, and frankly, to then be accountable to the American people first, and perhaps to his previous client, George W. Bush II, and putting those in order, I think he's had to go through a process of evolution after being so abjectly loyal. And frankly, for his corporate clients, one of his hallmarks back in Houston was that he was fiercely loyal. People loved him. They sought him out. Ultimately, extremely discreet and fiercely loyal, and he transferred those abilities to George W. Bush and was quite comfortable being the, quote, in-house counsel, again, both here in Texas and then in Washington. And would say in moments when he was challenged as White House counsel by Democrats, you know, hey, come clean on a particular report or memo or tell us what the true legal stance is, you know, for our edification. He would often reply, my oath of loyalty is to my client, and that's the president, and not to, in fact, the American people. He's in a different job now and quite a bit more accountable and frankly, obviously, a more public position. And I think we literally are seeing again in real time over the last year and a half this evolution from a man who's predisposed to keep things quiet because he's a discreet lawyer to being someone who's accountable nationally and publicly to the American people.
Let's move ahead to 2002 and the debate over detainees who were rounded up after September 11th. How involved was Gonzalez in the debate over how they were to be treated and the view of the Geneva Convention's limits on questioning enemy prisoners? Given what you've all said now, do you think that he was predisposed to give an opinion to reason the way he did to please the commander-in-chief?
Yeah, that's, again, the million-dollar question and really well-framed and very expertly edited and boiled down by you, so I appreciate it. You know, the question is, or if I may, you know, reframe it a little bit, too, the question being, did Gonzalez, you know, try to or identify the outcome first? This is the answer we want to achieve, and then work backwards to find the legal means necessary, and some would say the loopholes to achieve that answer. Here's what we want to have done. We want to hold detainees here at Guantanamo Bay. We want to hold secret military tribunals. Perhaps we'd also like to embark upon a domestic spying program that doesn't include the normal framework of issuing warrants and so forth. Those are the outcomes. Now let's work backwards to find the legal means to get there. Did that happen? I think in part it did. I do think in part. I think we'll have to wait until some more highly classified and extremely controversial memos will be released again. This is playing out in real time, as your caller noted. You know, it's on the front pages again today. Gonzalez, just by proximity to power, by the nameplate on his desk, counsel to the president, White House legal counsel, was hip deep involved in many of the internal discussions about all of these matters. There's a lot of discussion, you know, welling about in Washington and even kind of, you know, behind closed doors about what role did he play? Was he really more of a rubber stamp guy? Was it this sort of highly charged, very intense and focused group of younger lawyers who were filtering out from his office, from Vice President Cheney's office, over to the Department of Justice, kind of other younger, hungrier, and even less known than Gonzalez legal minds who were providing him this highly charged, almost combustible, this plutonium bits of legal advice that then were being shepherded very quickly to the president. Was Gonzalez actually the generator? Was he, where's the providence in all of this? What's clear, I mean, it's just manifestly clear, the documents are available, is that Gonzalez's name is affixed to many of these memos. These sort of internal drafts, once highly classified, now either declassified or frankly leaked to many media outlets and available to a lot of journalists. His name is there on several of them, including one that particularly will be affixed to Gonzalez for many years to come. It will be written about in his obituary, should that time come, that a memo that some critics say repudiates some of the truly ethical standards laid down by the Geneva Conventions, which are the generally agreed upon international protocols that many nations around the world agreed upon as it relates to the treatment of detainees, enemy combatants, prisoners of war. In one particular memo, and again, this is the one that I think will linger with Gonzalez for years and years, it appears that he suggests that the Geneva Conventions in part are quaint and obsolete and just frankly not applicable in this post-9/11 war on terror. That, to be honest, was the moment when that memo emerged and it became more broadly known. Alberto Gonzalez became a heck of a lot more infamous or famous overseas than he had ever been before. International human rights experts, international observers, people who were acutely familiar with how difficult it had been to create the Geneva Conventions and then get many nations to prescribe to them, were shocked, stunned, and he instantly, was vilified and assailed as being kind of the embodiment of a belief that exists out there that America had turned its back on the international community and frankly, had abandoned the high road that this country had traditionally assumed or presumed to take. An ethical, moral standard. Now, to connect the dots even further, many folks have said it was because of Gonzalez either acting as a brisk traffic cop and speeding these memos through to the president or perhaps even being the author of some of them, that you can connect the dots from these sort of internal discussions and memos that were being bandied about in the White House to the really wretched, excesses and abuses that we saw at Abu Ghraib, that those bits of paperwork created a culture and a mindset that trickled out of the White House, perhaps right out of Gonzalez's office, and all the way down into the rank and file, down to the foot soldiers, this creeping, gnawing sense that the usual rules of treatment don't apply because we're not fighting the usual kind of war, nor are these the usual enemy combatants. Again, a huge firestorm, an enormous controversy, and I think profound. A guy who grew up in a shack, in a little town called Humble, Texas, is now being faced not just with how to prosecute the war on terror in the legal sense of prosecute it, but really what America stands for. What we stand for as a people and as a nation. It's a profound leap, and that's really where it does become Shakespearean and Faustian and even a little bit of Greek tragedy in a sense. It's such a far leap from, a house with no hot running water and no telephone to really, being involved in internal discussions about what our country stands for.
How does he defend himself in the wake of the revelations about prisoner abuse,
sure,
torture?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. And he's, I would say, stylistically defended himself at times gingerly and at times more combatively in the sense that, he's taken some tough postures. What he's basically said is that a lot of critics are wrong to presume that discussions and paperwork and memos constituted exact policy, that what was leaked to the media, that what emerged in the media, that these bits of paperwork, that classified documents that have his name on it, and in particular, this one memo, signed by him that suggests the Geneva Conventions, again, are in part quaint or obsolete, and the U.S. doesn't need to abide by these universally agreed upon, or seemingly universally agreed upon, treatment standards for enemy combatants. He says that these were position papers, that they were just, quote, drafts, internal memos. They were discussions that were committed to paper and really, you know, kind of meant to be kicked around and bandied about and examined. What critics have said, and I suppose I'm now counting myself in that number, I'm not trying to bring any political bias to this. I'm trying to hover above it and look down upon it. It seems to me that would have been a neat counterbalance to these position papers would have been an equal number of position papers that do just that, that just counterbalance the other ones, that suggest fealty to certain standards, that suggest that, you know, quote, dot, 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 on the other hand, here's how we can view it. Those, by and large, those memos and documents don't exist. You have seemingly, you know, one set standard of thoughts about how to prosecute the war, and rather than making it, I suppose, more expansive, and really to not have things be in black and white, somewhere more in that gray area, you assemble the position papers from this side, and you have it well thought out and examined, and you have a position paper for the President of the United States to consider that reflects, you know, quote, the other side. To me and to some other observers, those other positions are not adequately represented yet thus far in papers that we've seen. So his contention in a nutshell, again, I'm sorry for waxing on, I feel like I'm running for office talking so long, but his contention is that these were just reflections or, you know, ruminations put to paper, and maybe at times have been misinterpreted by folks who have taken those memos that were delivered to the president as, you know, absolute fact and law.
Yeah, we only have a few minutes left here, and I've got a couple of questions on the table here that I really want to get to. Speaking of the other side, let's go back to Gonzalez as the governor's counselor. Mm-hmm. And this speaks to, I don't know, you know, this guy seems that his cards are held very tightly. Mm-hmm. But yet I see this bifurcation in how he grew up, where he grew up. It was really tough. Mexican Americans had it really tough in Houston in particular.
Yep.
The climate was really rough. Imagine him sitting in history class as a Mexican American in Texas.
Yep.
I don't have to say any more.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah, you're right.
Then, you know, it's do you stay true to your heritage, or do you say, you know, the heck with this? Let's move on. Let's move up. Start acting Anglo. Now let's go back to this issue of the governor's council, the other side. What was it like for him to have a role in the execution of a Mexican national?
Yeah, that's, a great, great question. And I, you forgive me for injecting these, you know, musical metaphors and analogies here about going down to the crossroads again, where you... old blues song is about going down to the crossroad and making a pact with the devil in some way, and I wouldn't go that far to suggest the devil was waiting for Alberto Gonzalez, but he went down to the crossroads in a lot of ways and had to make some fateful decisions. And literally, to summarize, as precisely, hopefully in some way, about what he was doing, the Texas, pejoratively nicknamed at times the state of death, you know, it has put more folks to death here on death row than any other state. And during George W. Bush's tenure as governor, Alberto Gonzalez, as his in-house counsel, was in charge of preparing clemency memos for Bush to review that would really be the last bits of paperwork that Bush would review before stopping an execution for 30 days or allowing it to go through. In 57 instances, 57 cases that Gonzalez directly handled, each of those cases he suggested, there wasn't a moment in any of those cases in which he said, time out, Governor, I think we need to really review this one, and let's grant the 30-day reprieve until this case could be more adequately analyzed. And of course, as you noted, Celeste, as in some of these cases, there were not just Mexican Americans, but even Mexican nationals involved on death row. And I think it presented, you know, I know from talking to his colleagues who were there with him making some of these decisions or advising him in some of these decisions, it was a really personally challenging moment, not just simply for the fact that these are life and death issues, but that it sprung out of a, you know, at times a wellspring of culture and heritage that he understood only all too well from growing up impoverished, and in cases where disproportionately people on death row tend to be minority figures. And so he brought all of that to the table. One thing that really knocked me for a loop, and I not to trumpet my work in any shape or form, but I just simply was unaware of it. There was a moment when Gonzalez had actually attended. I had gone into this book thinking that though he had essentially presided over and really, you know, quote, almost allowed to go forward 57 executions, that he had not attended one himself and didn't bring that frame of reference. But I was almost startled to learn in my research that he actually had attended one and tried to find out whether that had, you know, resonated with him on some deep personal emotional level. I wasn't able to really truly determine one way or the other. It seemed that, well, what was clear was that after that execution, he still, you know, went down the same road, the same path, and was as fiercely committed to being a proponent and supporter of the death penalty as was his chief client, the governor. But I know from, again, talking to many of his friends and colleagues that I call it the invisible 800-pound gorilla in the room that always follows Gonzalez. It's his heritage, and he's forever defined by it, forever stamped by it. There are conservatives who believe that he's a great supporter of affirmative action, because surely he's been the beneficiary of some of that. And it's very Shakespearean. It both haunts him and supports him in life. It's both a, perhaps, I suppose, a curse and a blessing.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Bill Minutaglio, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon and talking with our listeners this afternoon.
I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Bill is the author most recently of The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here is Tom Rogers.
That would be Tom Rogers.
Okay. Thanks, Tom.
Good guess. Let's start looking first of all at the wheat market in Kansas City, where it ended up mixed. The nearby contracts down half a penny, the March up a quarter of a penny, or a half a penny rather. In Chicago, the wheat market had an update today. But corn slid quite a bit on more follow-through from yesterday's sell-off, and the beans were rather flat to in negative territory. The September Kansas City wheat contract had a